Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 30th, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss the Ziegler versus Abbasi case decided earlier this week by the Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society, also General Counsel. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back repeat guest David B. Rivkin, Jr. He's a partner at the Baker & Hostetler Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C., also a good friend and supporter and leader of the Federalist Society. Welcome, David Rivkin. He's going to give us some opening remarks, 5 to 7 minutes or so, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please be having those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, David Rivkin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, very much. This is a case that was announced on Monday. That was the last day of this term. It's a very good case. To give you sort of my bottom line, I would call this case basically the death of Bivens. The facts are as follows. This is a long-lasting legal exercise where in the aftermath of 9/11, you had a number of individuals, including numerous legal aliens, who were taken into custody and held on a variety of grounds, some as possible material witnesses, some as possible suspects. They were detained, I would say, somewhere from 3 to 6 or 8 months, eventually released and deported. They filed a lawsuit against two categories of federal defendants. Senior government officials were included, then Attorney General Ashcroft, then FBI Director Mueller, who subsequently went on to new things, and the name party in a case caption is Ziegler, who I believe was Commissioner of INS. And then you had your typical conditions of confinement lawsuit against various sadistic wardens and assistant wardens. So the case came to the Supreme Court. The basic cause of action is Bivens, which is an old cause of action, exercise of federal common law, where the courts are dealing with situations where Congress, where Article I has not created a cause of action, has not created a remedy, and the courts have inferred it. So they have lost. Let's leave the issues regarding wardens aside, because quite frankly, it's not interesting. That interesting, as far as the senior government officials are concerned, the challenge is lost in the district court. They've done better in the Second Circuit, somewhat surprisingly, since it's not the Ninth Circuit. And then it came to the Supreme Court. You have a Kennedy majority opinion that basically. Robustly rearticulates why Bivens is a disfavored cause of action. There are really only 3 Bivens cases, all of which date to the 1970s, which are Bivens itself. The second case is Davis versus Passman that had to do with gender discrimination. And then the last one is Carlson versus Green that had to do with cruel and unusual punishment clause case, particularly withholding medical care from the inmate, and the court said before that we're not going to extend Bivens to new circumstances, absent some compelling special considerations, and an excellent opinion by Kennedy that goes through first explaining what it means to say new circumstances, new context. It's not enough, by the way, to say, well, this is a violation of Eighth Amendment or this is a violation of a Fourth Amendment. You need to look at the same factual, in order to be in the same place as previous Bivens cases, you have to have substantial similarity in the factual context, which is not the case here, because obviously you have not had any challenges in most free cases that I mentioned to the senior government level governmental decision-making involving national security. And then their opinion goes through the analysis of whether or not there are special factors that would come out differently, and there are really none here that would counsel in favor of creating a new Bivens remedy. What I wanted to mention, and I think it's very, very important, is that this opinion echoes the deference that Article III owes to two political branches in the foreign affairs context, and therefore, at least at the metaphorical level, is something you can link to the court's per curiam opinion in the executive order stay, because Kennedy, in going for a special factors analysis, says that because we're dealing with national security, where the political branches have a dominant sway and judiciary is engaged with considerable hesitation and they're reluctant to intrude on the executive branch decision making, at least, and that's important, absent congressional, specific congressional authorization. So that's a very, very, very good discussion. And again, it reminds me of at least the tenor of a court's opinion in the executive order. So it's really not a whole lot to say here. Again, I would just say that to me, at least, look, one can always try. To me, it presages the end of efforts that you see from time to time to extend Bivens to new circumstances. As far as sort of if you want to know where the balance of a court is, you basically have a Kennedy delivered opinion in which Roberts, Thomas, and Alito have, well, there's a little bit of variability in terms of which portions they join, but to say for the sake of his discussion, joined. You have a Breyer and Ginsburg dissent, and the Sotomayor and Kagan and Gorsuch took no part in this. I would guess that if Kagan, Sotomayor, and Gorsuch participated in this, it probably would have been a 5-4 opinion, which again is I have no doubt predicting that Gorsuch would have come out the same way as the majority. I'm somewhat reluctantly predicting that Sotomayor would have come out in the same way as Breyer and Ginsburg. My hope would have been that Kagan may have not gone this way, but that's a bit of a stretch. Anyway, let me stop here and see if you have any questions.
Terrific. Thank you very much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our guest, David Rifkin, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me make a quick commercial announcement about our next scheduled teleforum conference call. That's next Wednesday at 2 p.m., another Supreme Court decision that we'll be discussing next Wednesday at 2 p.m. at this same number. If you have a question today, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, but before we go to our first caller, let me ask a quick question just to clarify, David Rifkin, and that is, the court did not extend Bivens to the facts here. They also didn't overrule it. Is that correct? They just distinguished the current case.
Right, but I would say I want to be careful of nomenclature. The triptych of the Bivens cases that I mentioned at the front end, Bivens itself, Passman and Carlson, basically they're not overruled, but let's just say they're limited to the unique factual circumstances, which basically means they hold no precedential sway. Now, if you have a case like, for example, Carlson, where you have a prisoner who has a serious health condition and is denied just, and I'm not talking about not getting the best quality care or having to wait a little bit, but just bluntly denied access to life-saving care, you would have another Carlson type case, but in all other circumstances, aside from those free silos, I think Bivens is dead, and that's really the sort of a broad import of this case.
Very good. Once again, if you have a question for David Rifkin, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now go to our first caller.
Hi, Bob Fitzpatrick. I think you just answered my question. It was going to be what's left of Bivens, and you just said it's dead, except if you have cases that pretty much mirror the facts in that trilogy. So I guess my question's been answered, but if there's anything more you want to say about the death of Bivens, I'm all ears.
I happen to think that this is, and this is not a question of how solicitous one wants to be to the rights of a claimant. I frankly, for example, have done several Section 1983 cases that, as you may know, is a remedy, of course, created by Congress in the context of the of a Civil Rights Act of 1864, and that's only applicable against state officials. And having seen some serious constitutional violations, a number of which occurred in the previous 8 years, but not uniquely so, I often would have liked to see a congressionally created cause of action similar to 1983 against federal officials. But looking at it from a constitutional perspective, I think that I certainly disfavor, and so does the Supreme Court, judicially created causes of action. And particularly, it's one thing to create federal common law in some interstitial spaces like interstate pollution in a situation where you cannot demonstrate that Congress displaced what the judiciary is trying to do from some statute. But creating judicial remedies in a context of, you know, the core functions of the federal government, particularly, you know, in foreign affairs, but also, you know, prison policy, et cetera, it's just a very, very unfortunate development, I think, as a matter of separation of powers and proper judicial competence. By the way, one interesting detail here, Kennedy begins his analysis by pointing out that Congress did indeed enact Section 1983, which I just mentioned, that does provide for statutory remedies against state government officials who, let's say, generally speaking, violate constitutional rights, and Congress declined to do so in the context of federal government officials. So that is quite instructive as far as the judiciary is concerned, because it certainly illustrates the proposition that Congress, you know, approached this issue and with, you know, some level of discernment and chose to go after, to allow these types of lawsuits against state government officials and not against federal government officials.
Thank you. That's very, very helpful.
Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, now's the time to ask it. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask you, while we're waiting to see if somebody else rings in, you mentioned Ziegler. Jim Ziegler was the head of INS. And this case, I didn't think bear his name the entire time, but it did for a while. Why did it take so long for this case to get to the Supreme Court and reach a decision when it seems like it's I don't want to say it's an easy case for the court, but it seems from your rendering a pretty clear result.
Well, yes, and it's a couple of observations. One is fairly pedestrian. The other one hopefully is more interesting. The more pedestrian consideration is there was a considerable period of time after the individuals, and again, the main dramatis personae as far as the challenges are concerned, I think are five or six individuals of Arab descent, if I'm not mistaken. So a fair amount of time passed since they were removed from the United States and got lured up or had lawyers volunteered to represent them in this matter and filed those lawsuits. Second, again, it was not prosecuted very aggressively as far as the run-up for the district court. And the Second Circuit is not the slowest circuit, but, I mean, yes, you're right. It took considerable amount of time. But the broader proposition here, I think, is that if you're asking me why did the Second Circuit get it wrong, I mean, judiciary is, you know, only to a certain degree is a hierarchical branch, and it's, in that respect, it's quite different from Article II. it's not as chaotic as Congress, but there's a lot of, shall we say, willingness by the lower courts, particularly district courts, but also circuit courts, to try to work around judicial precedent, so, or Supreme Court precedent. So, it's illustrative, I also think, as to why judiciary would be a major play in foreign affairs, because in addition to the lack of knowledge, they also would not be able to have any degree of uniformity. So we would have not only the judiciary as an institution micromanaging foreign policy, but we would have very strong differences in which portion of judiciary folks in the heartland judges in the heartland would slice things one way, and the ones on the coast would do it quite differently. So they would give a new meaning to the term circuit split.
Very good. Our lines are wide open now. We're going to call for the last question now. If somebody has a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Got quite a few people hanging on the line here. Push the star button and the pound button.
All right. Well, speak for the 4th of July, huh?
I guess, 4th of July. It does seem like we've had the last question, and Bivens is dead, as you said. Anything to say in terms of a final thought, David Rifkin?
No, it's a good case. It would have been a very bad precedent had it come out otherwise. And again, this is useful to me from two perspectives, all anchored in the separation of powers context. One is manifests continued judicial modesty at the Supreme Court level when it comes to foreign affairs, and second, manifests continuing reluctance again at the Supreme Court level to engaging in creation of implied causes of action in a situation where the political branches have not seen to provide them. So both things are quite good, and venture bold observation, even though it has nothing to do with Ziegler. I'm quite optimistic, but then it comes to the merits with a stay issue or a challenge to the executive order that I think is set for the first week of October, that we're going to have a strong majority decision that upholds the administration's effort. And again, I don't hold any candle for the policy aspects of executive orders. Reasonable people can disagree, but as a constitutional proposition, I think it would be enormously useful to really vindicate the proposition that while judiciary, of course, is not absent in the context of adjudicating cases that implicate foreign policy issues, the model of judicial engagement in that space is fundamentally different from the one involving domestic issues. When it comes to foreign policy, you have a near absolute deference, not an absolute one, but near absolute deference. You do not look beyond the four corners of the justification proffered by the by Article 2, provided it is bona fide, and most importantly, from my perspective, beyond that, judiciary really does not engage in any serious balancing exercise, unlike in a domestic space. And again, whatever you think about the policy merits of this controversy, this relative judicial detachment from these types of issues, I think, is a good thing, separation of powers-wise, as well as in the long run, policy-wise. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. As always, my thanks to David Rifkin. We appreciate that. It's nice to have a case that, as you say, could have gone wrong but didn't go wrong. So it's good to hear from you, as always. And to the audience, thank you as well for dialing in for your thoughtful questions. Happy Independence Day to everyone. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is next Wednesday at 2 p.m. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.